the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. May Martinez. President Trump says the FDA is looking to make experimental drugs available in the fight against coronavirus. We'll hear how realistic that plan is. Plus, using a bus or a train seems to run counter to social distancing recommendations, but they're both still up and running in LA, taking some extra levels of precaution, though, to get riders on their way. That's coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Thursday. Thanks for being with us today. Later in the show, as promised, we'll provide you a moment of zen and a bit of a laugh. First, though, the news. Los Angeles County Public Health just wrapped up its daily press briefing. Officials reported a second death due to COVID-19. He was young, but he did have underlying health conditions. Now, the news comes as 40 new cases of the disease were also confirmed. And Director Barbara Ferrer says it's likely they'll find more people who have contracted the virus.
We're going to continue to see an increase in positive cases over the next 4 to 12 weeks. But that doesn't mean that the important actions that you're all taking to combat this virus are not working.
Yeah, because on the positive side, she said 7 labs throughout LA County are online now for testing. Now, earlier this morning, the Trump administration, during a press briefing, said it asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to fast-track antiviral treatments for coronavirus. Here's FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn.
As the president mentioned, he asked us to be aggressive, to break down barriers to innovation, and to accelerate the development of life-saving treatments. And we're doing that at the FDA. The FDA is committed to continuing to provide regulatory flexibility and guidance. But let me make one thing clear. FDA's responsibility to the American people is to ensure that products are safe and effective.
And to answer our questions about this and other matters related to the COVID-19 virus, we turn now to Dr. Robert Kim Farley. He's with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health and a former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. Doctor, welcome back.
It's my pleasure to be back.
Before we get into everything, I just want to know, how are things going for you and at UCLA with everything happening right now?
Well, we're busy in the sense that professors like myself are having to plan for our courses going to an online environment. And from myself and other of my colleagues that are involved with the coronavirus preparedness, we are involved with campus committees, and also, of course, to be able to be available to you and your listeners like your program to be able to get out the word and get out information that's scientifically valid and factual in a manner that's calm and approachable.
Perfect. And that's exactly why we appreciate your presence on the show. Now, at the press conference today, Dr. Hahn mentioned two potential treatments the FDA was exploring as treatments, chloroquine and something called convalescent plasma. So let's talk about chloroquine first. What is it and why is the federal government interested in it?
So chloroquine is actually, some of your listeners may realize it's a name that they may have heard before because it is something that was used for anti-malaria. It's been not as used as much just because of the fact we've had so much resistance to it in the malaria field. However, given it's been used since 1945, we know a lot about its safety and conditions. And it's interesting that some initial investigations found that about a quarter of patients who received chloroquine tested positive for the virus after 6 days, compared with like 90% who didn't receive it. So that's interesting that it may actually have some antiviral properties against COVID-19. And that's one of the reasons why the World Health Organization is, in fact, undertaking clinical trials with this. We'll be also doing it here in the United States and other places as well to see what might be the effect of this old drug in our malaria arsenal coming to a 21st century use for a emerging virus disease
now,
like this.
Yeah, but I want to be clear, though. It's not something that's ready now or in a week or in a month.
Correct in the sense that the drug is here, it's ready, but the question is how efficacious is it? What would be the indications for its use? And that really has to await some clinical trials before put into widespread use or recommendation by the Food and Drug Administration. I just might mention this fast track that you started your program off. That is a designation used by the FDA for an investigational drug where they do expedited review to help facilitate the development of the drugs that are a threat or serious for a serious condition, a life-threatening condition. And we don't currently have any medical treatment for it. So that's why you fast track something like this, and it means that they enter into partnership with the drug manufacturer to have frequent review to try to expedite the process, but not shortcut the process sense of, you know, making it something that could be harmful for people as well.
That's what I think everyone was hoping to hear, that they're not rushing and maybe making mistakes. So what about convalescent plasma? What is that, and how might it be used to treat people?
Yeah, so convalescent plasma is the idea that you have somebody who has recovered from COVID-19, so they now have antibody to this virus, and so you take their plasma or their blood serum, you isolate those antibodies, and you give it to somebody who is experiencing COVID-19, who may be critically ill, to see if this could, in fact, speed their recovery and make it so that they don't come even worse. This was used for some people, for example, during the Spanish influenza in 1918. They did use this sort of approach. I think the downsides is that it is difficult to scale up to large, widespread use. But there is another approach that is similar in a sense, that convalescent plasma, again, has these antibodies. But we now have technologies that can make antibodies synthetically. And, in fact, one company in the United States here, Regeneron, is actually looking to be able to identify antibodies that protect against COVID-19 and be able to manufacture them synthetically. So that could be something that might be very promising. The only thing I also would caution about antibody therapies or convalescent plasma therapy is that it is short-lived, in the sense that when you make your own antibody, they will stay for longer periods of time. If you're giving someone passively antibody from someone else or from a synthetic source, the body over time degrades that antibody, and therefore it probably would not be for long periods of time.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. All right, let's get to some listener questions. And a lot of these hit along the same themes here, which is symptoms and contagiousness. So first up, one anonymous listener asked, if someone has the coronavirus, can they get better on their own? How long would it take, and how long is someone contagious after the virus?
Yes. So, in fact, yes, they can be better on their own. For people who have mild symptoms of COVID-19, physicians are in fact advising them to stay at home, isolating themselves from others, but that unless those severe symptoms develop, they don't actually need to be hospitalized. So yes, that can happen. And in terms of the infectivity to others, probably at least 72 hours after symptoms resolve, they are still infectious. Some studies have shown that the virus particles can still be recovered up to 20 days or so after infection, but maybe that really is, although recoverable, may not actually be a significant source of transmission. By the way, I just might also go back one quick thing, just mention that in addition to those antimalarial drug like chloroquine or the convalescent plasma we discussed, there's actually some other promising drugs, Kaletra, for example, that used to be used for HIV or is used for HIV, I should say. There's also an anti-flu drug, Favipiravir, that could be useful in this setting as well, and even an Ebola drug that was developed, Remdesivir, that is being looked at as well. So there's a lot of promising work being done by companies working with FDA about other treatment modalities. And realizing, too, there's two aspects of treatment. You can treat people who are ill with these drugs if they prove to be beneficial, but there may be opportunities for it to be used in prevention, not necessarily for a widespread population, but let's say in a nursing home, if it became introduced there, you might be able to give a promising antiviral as a preventive, like we do with oseltamivir or Tamiflu for influenza in a nursing home setting.
Now, in this same vein, Dr. Sue Musto asked, how do you know when you're out of the woods for serious complications?
Yes, so if you have COVID-19 and you have developed symptoms, that probably within about a week, maximum 2 weeks, you will know if you're going to actually get severe symptoms, in which case you have to go into the hospital and, depending on the severity, might even have to have intensive care unit support for on a ventilator, for example, if you had severe pneumonia.
You know, we've also received a lot of questions about incubation and symptoms. So how long does it typically take for someone who is infected to show symptoms if they are not asymptomatic?
And you bring up a good point that many may be totally asymptomatic and not have symptoms. 80% of people will probably have very mild symptoms. So, and that usually incubation period about 2 days to 14 days on the range of it, but usually about 5 to 6 days is the typical average incubation period for COVID-19.
All right. Now, for those who find themselves living with someone who is showing symptoms, Laura Galenbach wants to know best tips for sharing a house with someone exhibiting flu symptoms and not catching it yourself. She writes that they're sleeping in separate rooms, using separate bathrooms. He's got separate food and drinks to reduce germ sharing, and she's wiping down really high touch areas. So any other suggestions to add to that?
Yeah, so, you know, this sounds like Laura's done a really great job in trying to care for their loved ones in the home. I think a couple of other things that she may wish to consider is that when she enters the room to have the person who is sick, they wear a surgical mask so that basically if they're coughing, that coughing doesn't come onto her. So I think that's one thing that she could additionally do in that setting.
One thing I saw, Doctor, that the CDC approved scarves for medical professionals kind of as an emergency way to provide something like a mask. Is that something that maybe I could use or just the general public could use possibly?
Well, again, I think the main issue for mask use is for someone who is ill themselves so that they don't, you know, cough and project their droplet spread to others. It's also very helpful for mask use if you're caring for someone. And when you're in their presence, or a healthcare worker, those are important areas where masks are needed. I think what CDC is really mentioning here is the idea that sometimes, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. Are the use of a scarf ideal? No, but it may be better than nothing in that setting. But again, for people in the general population walking around, this is not really being promoted to use masks in general.
All right, one more question, Doctor. A lot of listeners, including John Ruth, want to know how long before a test shows positive, assuming no symptoms have presented?
Yes, so basically our tests will show positive when you have enough viral particles, if you will, that have multiplied in your body to be able to be detected. So usually within 1 to 2 days would be a timing when you would expect that the test would become positive after infection.
And actually,
even still showing necessarily symptoms.
No, one more thing, Doctor. Only because we keep hearing it all the time. It's spring. The first day of spring is tomorrow, I think, or tonight or tomorrow. But it's coming up. We keep hearing that the virus cannot survive in warm weather. Just set everyone straight on that.
Yes. So it's not that it cannot survive in warm weather. We do not know exactly how COVID-19 is going to respond, but it has been felt that other coronaviruses like SARS did decrease in the warm climates. So we may see reduced transmission happening in the summer months. So there may be some seasonality to this. We shall see over time. But remember that what might be good news from our side could be bad news for the Southern Hemisphere, should that be the case as they go into their winter.
Dr. Robert Kim Farley is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Doctor, we appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
All right, all this coverage of coronavirus and everything you hear on KPCC is really only possible because listeners just like you step up and support it. And today, we would have been right in the middle of our spring member drive. Instead, we're focusing on giving you fact-based information to try and handle this this crazy time in our history. So please, please give us a call at 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722 or kpcc.org and give to continue this kind of coverage. More Take Two coming right up.
This is a mean old world to live in all by yourself.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. CMA Martinez. Professional and personal lives have been dramatically upended by the spread of COVID-19, but regional public transit in Greater Los Angeles is still moving. With us now to discuss what the coronavirus means for LA County public transportation is KPCC's Ryan Fonseca. Ryan, welcome back.
Hi.
Buses and trains seem to be up and running for the most part, but what can we expect in the coming weeks?
Right. Yeah. So most bus and train services in the county are still operational. They have been scaled down, though, or amended their schedules in some places. But for the most part, it's basically a kind of a wait and see day by day approach right now. And, agencies are taking their cues from public health officials about what to do next. So right now, Metro is running regular weekday service. Agency officials say there's currently no plans to shut down, but they did say it's possible they could adjust service on certain lines based on what they called street realities.
Street realities. Okay. Now, riding public transportation seems to fit all the criteria of what we're being told not to do. Gather in close proximity, touching the same things as other people. So, Ryan, what is LA County doing to make public transportation safe?
Yeah, it is basically the kind of the situation that we've been advised to avoid, right? But a lot of LA County residents simply don't have an alternative for travel. It's their mobility safety net, one agency official said this week. For a lot of Angelenos who work in hospitals or nursing homes or other vital service industries right now, they need to work and they don't have other options. So that's why LA Metro and other transit networks are, you know, still up and running because it's so vital for so many workers right now. Metro's main message is that if its system is not vital for you, don't take it. So stay home. But if you do need to take it, Metro says it's doing everything it can to ensure riders stay safe. So far, there's no confirmed cases of coronavirus contracted through Metro's system, and the agency says they're not aware of any employees or contractors that have tested positive for the virus. Several employees have self-quarantined, though, after international travel as a precaution. I was told that earlier this week, but again, no known confirmed cases among Metro staff.
What's Metro doing to keep things clean?
So they are cleaning and disinfecting their buses and trains every day. Overnight, they do this cleaning. You know, the trains end up at these train yards or bus yards overnight, and then they have custodial staff that go through, do a deep cleaning, sweep, mopping, disinfecting. So that happens, you know, every night overnight before service resumes in the morning. And then they're also doing what they're calling a strengthened cleaning at major transit hubs. That includes Union Station, the El Monte bus hub. And the goal there is really to focus on these frequently touched services. So doors, you know, handrails, and the tap vending machines. And the agency says it's following, you know, the guidance of public health officials.
Ryan, what about bus drivers? They're in close contact with people on those buses.
Right now, they really aren't doing anything extra special other than, you know, just our normal social distancing. But you know, they're having some questions about, are they wearing gloves? Are they wearing masks? But Metro says it's following public health guidelines right now, which don't call for bus drivers to wear masks or gloves. But that, of course, could change. And the workers right now that are really taking extra precautions are custodial workers. They have masks and gloves that Metro's given out to them. And they're sort of this key line of defense as they're ramping up cleaning, right, at transit hubs like Union Station. So I said key line because I'm not really sure if they're considered the first line or the last line of defense, to be honest. We've spoke to Barbara Ferrer, who's, you know, the director of LA County Public Health, and she said really the single best protection against coronavirus on public transit is for sick people to stay home. You know, she mentioned Metro could do all the cleaning in the world, but if people who are sick or maybe infected are still on the system, that, you know, presents the biggest risk for other riders.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wondering how all this has affected ridership. I got to guess it's gone down.
Yeah, it is. It is down. Kind of anecdotally is what we're seeing right now. Metro officials have just said there's fewer riders on the system, but they're not providing detailed numbers right now. Those are usually released in the middle of the month for the previous month. So we should have a sense of the impact Metro felt this month in mid-April. I was told just today that Metro CEO Philip Washington is scheduled to hold a press conference tomorrow morning to discuss ridership and other impacts to the system.
What about the city's scooters, cars, and bike share programs? Are they still operating as usual? I gotta say, I haven't seen as many scooters around town anymore.
So one company, Lime, actually announced they were going to pull their scooters off the streets throughout California. They're also doing the same thing in Washington State and a few other countries, too, around the world, just out of an abundance of caution. So far, it's the only scooter company to do that. Several of the other companies licensed to operate in the city have already announced enhanced cleaning and employee hygiene procedures, and they are encouraging riders to, you know, wipe down touch points like handlebars before and after use. The LA City Council is asking the LADOT to kind of establish and report back with these updated sanitation protocols for e-scooters and e-bikes. As far as other vehicles, you know, the city partners with this company called Blue LA, which does electric car sharing, and that whole service has been suspended indefinitely in the city.
Now, what about other cities in LA County? Are we seeing different approaches to public transportation throughout?
Yeah, again, some amending of services, but overall, you know, these services are still up and running. You know, Foothill Transit, Antelope Valley Transit Authority, and then cities like Glendale, Burbank, and Santa Monica operate their own bus services. So in Santa Monica, for example, the Big Blue Bus is, they've halted services on just a few lines, kind of to ensure a continuity of operations and as a way to kind of match ridership demand. Most bus service, though, in other cities is still, you know, operating as normal, Glendale, Burbank, Pasadena. Culver City Bus is actually waiving fares for riders starting today, and they're asking riders to board using the rear door just to limit contact with bus drivers. So that's really the only thing I've seen so far as far as an agency that's looking to provide that extra layer of protection for bus drivers is it's limiting front door boarding for just people with mobility needs. And then certain buses in Culver City are running on a Saturday service timeline. But again, places like Pasadena Transit, they have not only buses, but then on-demand shuttle services for seniors and people with disabilities, and those remain in service as of this week.
All right, one more thing, Ryan. Will folks who have monthly Metro passes but are now working from home or self-quarantining and aren't using their passes, will they be able to get their money back?
Yeah, Metro says yes. Just make sure that they're hanging on to those passes, and then once people start riding again, any customers that are affected by that monthly pass are asked to call 866-TAP-TO-GO. And they can add additional days back on their tap cards.
Ryan Fonseca covers transportation and mobility for LAS.com and KPCC. Ryan, thanks.
Thanks, A.
It's been a lot harder to do business as usual with so many people at home because of the coronavirus. Sure, it might be nice to do all that conference call in your sweatpants, but some workers are missing face-to-face contact with their coworkers. And while the technology sure is there, we all know it's not 100% perfect. Many companies have started using video conferencing services such as Zoom to communicate with their employees, which is cool. But as people start using more video chats and relying on that extra secure virtual private network or VPN to log into work, they're putting an unprecedented strain on the nation's internet infrastructure. So how will it all hold up during this time of quarantine? Let's ask Josephine Wolf, assistant professor of cybersecurity policy at Tufts University. She's also the author of a recent New York Times op-ed titled "The Internet Isn't Ready for Coronavirus." Josephine, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, we'll get into why the internet isn't ready in just a second. But first, can you walk us through what the infrastructure looks like? Is it really just a series of tubes?
Well, it is. There are a lot of wires involved, okay, or cables. And what I would say is sort of an important distinction to understand is in the United States especially, there's a lot of capacity for our internet traffic. But that's often what we call sort of the backhaul or the centralized capacity, the residential capacity, the cables that actually go out to your individual home and those of all of your neighbors are not set up necessarily to deal with the kind of traffic that we have in our corporate offices, our universities, the places that are used to passing an enormous amount of traffic every day.
And those neighborhoods are now corporate offices and university classes. That's what they all are right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what could some of the internet's infrastructure breaking points be?
So there are a couple areas that I worry about. One is those residential last mile links where you're seeing sort of that thin, or not thin, but the relatively small cable going out to individual homes clogging up as more and more people are staying home trying to do video conferencing and other types of online work. And that would be one choke point. You would worry about a lot of congestion. Another area would be the VPNs, the virtual private networks that a lot of companies are relying on right now to keep their proprietary corporate information secret when all of it is passing over the open internet. And for something to pass through a VPN, it has to pass through special encrypted servers that the company is running or that another company is running on their behalf. And a lot of those VPNs are not set up for the entire company to be operating through them, just for folks who are traveling or working remotely. And that's another area where we're starting to see a lot of strain, a lot of companies sort of trying to come to terms very quickly with what it means to ramp up that capacity so quickly.
Josephine, what would the consequences be if, say, Zoom's servers go down?
So if the capacity for a system like Zoom went down right now, what you would see is a lot of companies and a lot of schools and universities that are relying on that, probably beginning with having fairly poor connectivity. So you would be trying to join a Zoom call or a Zoom class, and you would find that it wasn't happening quickly, or when you were able to join, you weren't actually getting very good quality of service. You couldn't see the video, you couldn't hear the audio smoothly. And then a lot of the sort of backup systems that we're trying to piece together for education, for work, would start very quickly to seem much less reliable and much less functional than we want them to be.
Amazon Web Services are also under greater strain during this time. What about them?
So Amazon Web Services are going to really have a moment to shine here, I think. And probably if you're a service like Zoom and you're ramping up capacity very quickly, that's one of the places you're looking to get server space. And if we're lucky, then it's going to turn out that the big cloud service providers like Amazon, like Microsoft, are going to be able to meet that demand. I think that's less likely to be a choke point than the actual transportation infrastructure of the internet, but we're going to find out.
Talking to Josephine Wolfe, Assistant Professor of Cybersecurity Policy at Tufts University. Now, of course, people use the internet for all kinds of things, work, play, and regulators are now turning their attention to streaming entertainment services. So Netflix announced today that it will limit its video capacity for users across Europe. The company estimates that this will reduce their traffic by 25%. So streaming movies, Josephine, TV shows clearly has had an effect on our internet capacity. How big is it exactly?
So it's an enormous portion of the day-to-day internet traffic we see, somewhere between a third to a half of the traffic in the United States, we've seen estimates. And if this works, if we're able to do remote education and remote work even close to the way we want to be able to do it, it's going to be completely thanks to services like Netflix that have helped us ramp up our capacity to be able to stream those shows and movies at the kind of high-quality, high-definition streams that they've provided.
They also provide a big distraction for a lot of people going through this really stressful time. Do you think it's still okay to stream all your favorite shows and movies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one thing that's really important is this is not like if you're hoarding all of the hand sanitizer, nobody else gets any, right? If you're using your local link to the internet and there isn't congestion where you are, then there's no reason not to be watching a movie or distracting yourself or anything like that. If there is congestion, you'll notice and you'll be aware of that. So I certainly wouldn't say that people should stop using the internet for anything except absolutely critical work calls.
I'm so glad I haven't thrown away my DVD player and VCR. I still got them in the garage, just in case, right?
That was a good choice. Like
no internet connection is going to ruin that. We mentioned how Netflix is pulling back. So what else should companies and even just individual people think about during this time?
So I think the most important thing for companies, for teachers, for students to be thinking about right now is what they can do asynchronously online, because we know that the internet sort of goes through these cycles of peak traffic and lower traffic. And if you're trying to do everything synchronously in real time with people you're working with or teaching, then everybody needs to be online at the same time, regardless of how much burden there is on the network at that time. But if you can do more things that feel a little lower tech, like email or recorded lectures and lessons, or things that people can log on and download or access at perhaps a less pressing crunch time for the network, then it's easier to spread out some of that traffic and it doesn't feel quite so challenging when there are connectivity troubles.
Now, one thing you wrote in your op-ed that I think maybe, Josephine, people aren't thinking about right off the top is hackers. When it comes to hackers right now, they might find this as an opportunity to infiltrate corporate networks. How would they be able to do that right now?
So the biggest risk for a lot of companies that are taking all of their employees to remote work is going to be the question of what happens if people are trying to spy on those meetings or access that proprietary intellectual property as it's all moving off of those corporate campuses and into people's homes. And there would be a couple different ways that you could do that, right? One would be you could try to use stolen credentials to access these VPNs or remote networks. And it's going to be a lot harder for companies to notice that that's going on if they have thousands of employees logging in remotely, then being able to say, oh, here's this, you know, weird thing that's happening. Somebody's logging in remotely and downloading a lot of data. It's just going to be harder to flag and notice that that's going on. So that would be one area of concern. Mm-hmm. I think another is with those VPNs I mentioned. If those get overloaded and people start thinking, oh, it's actually quicker or easier for me not to be doing something through that VPN, then all of a sudden you've removed a really important layer of protection for that corporate information.
Yeah, that VPN won't be as private as the P in the VPN stands for. Josephine Wolfe is an assistant professor of cybersecurity policy at Tufts University. Josephine, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Now for another mid-show moment of Zen. With so much going on these days, it can be hard to find a little peace of mind. So, as often as possible, we're going to bring you encouraging words from members of our community to help slow down, take a breath, and maybe find some peace. Today, we bring you a piece written and read by former Pasadena resident Cameron Bellum. It's titled Prayer for a Pandemic.
May we who are merely inconvenienced remember those whose lives are at stake. May we who have no risk factors remember those most vulnerable. May we who have the luxury of working from home remember those who must choose between preserving their health or making their rent. May we who have the flexibility to care for our children when their schools close remember those who have no options. May we who have to cancel our trips remember those that have no safe place to go. May we who are losing our margin money in the tumult of the economic market remember those who have no margin at all. May we who settle in for a quarantine at home remember those who have no home. As fear grips our country, let us choose love. During this time when we cannot physically wrap our arms around each other, let us yet find ways to be the loving embrace of God to our neighbors. Amen.
All right, if you're working from home and listening to us, thank you very, very much for doing that. And here's the thing to keep in mind. You're working from home, so that means you got a check coming. A lot of your neighbors, and by neighbors I mean everyone that lives here in LA, a lot of your neighbors have no idea where their next check's going to come from, and they rely on KPCC to give them fact-based information, stuff that they can use and not panic around. And here's the thing with that is that we need to fundraise. We need to actually put this on the air. You could help us by giving at kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org, or call 866-888-5722. Thanks a lot. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, let's step away from the coronavirus coverage for just a second and talk about something else. Anything else right now would be great. Well, so how about marmalade? Sitting in the shadow of Mount Wilson in the heart of Sierra Madre, there's a little yellow house that holds a story of a local business that's more than 100 years old. This business, E. Waldo Ward and Son Marmalades, has lived through the many phases of Los Angeles, but many of its recipes remain the same, and it's the topic of this week's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
And Esoteric Tour's Richard Shave is here to tell us all about the business. Richard, welcome back.
Great to be back, eh? Thanks for having me.
All right, now, E. Waldo Ward and Son Marmalades has been operating out of this house for more than 100 years. Describe the property for us.
It's in the foothills of Sierra Madre. It is nestled in a nice little residential development, which has grown up around this citrus orchard. So you drive up and you walk up the oak-lined driveway, which has a beautiful river rock wall on your right. Directly in front of you is an old barn, which is their gift shop where you buy these great marmalades. And on the right is this yellow Queen Anne house, which Waldo, great-grandfather, the founder, he built in 1902, about 10 years before he would go into the marmalade business. It is from the balcony of this house in 1934 when his grandson Richard is born that he screams, "It's a boy," and apparently it was heard in Azusa.
No kidding, that far, huh? Wow.
Waldo.
Booming voice.
Waldo was known for his booming voice. You continue walking beyond the Borden-Batten red barn, which houses Richard's truck as a vintage, perfect 1952 Chevrolet. Nothing says Southern California to me quite like a trip out to Waldo Ward.
Sounds glorious. All right, so tell us the story of the man behind the business, Edwin Waldo Ward.
Waldo, as his friends call him. Waldo comes out to Southern California in 1894. He is selling dry goods to the railroads. He realizes the potential for Southern California. He starts to buy the land, which will become his citrus orchard. He plants trees. By 1904, he's built this house, and he's still just selling merchandise through dry good companies to railroads. 1917, he founds the E. Waldo Ward Company, and he gets the concession to sell marmalade to Harvey Houses. This is the restaurant that's attached to the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe and has restaurants at all of their major depots. And that really makes him. I mean, this is just an incredibly lucrative contract. And they've never looked back from there. So they specialize in marmalades and preserves, a lot of the items that are on their shelves today. They've been around since 1917.
Now, what types of marmalade did he end up making?
You have, let's see, the Seville Sweet Orange Marmalade, popular in 1917, still a top seller today. Kumquat Marmalade, Valencia Orange Marmalade, and the Fig Jam. Those four really were their heavy hitters 100 years ago, and they're still racking up the sales today.
Still today, wow. So what that people liked back then, if it's still good, it's what they eat today.
Correct.
Yeah, holds up.
But they look ahead. Jeff, the great-grandson, who's now in charge today, you know, has just come up. His honey-glazed sriracha barbecue sauce is very popular. And he says, he'll be really honest with you, this is a sauce that has one foot in the early 20th century and one foot in the 21st century. He really has a touch of a flavor profile for the 21st century. And he's really trying to look ahead and see people's changing tastes and intrigue them and surprise them.
What place did these marmalades hold in the food economy back then? Because I'm guessing it must have been a very popular brand.
There's no refrigeration. Citrus fruit lasts maybe a couple of weeks, you know, fresh. People ate preserved foods unless they were just getting locally sourced foods. The railroads, you could throw these in carts and just send them across the country. It was a preeminently commodifiable product.
You mentioned how the family has always tried to keep an eye on the future a little bit when it comes to their products. But take us through the generations. I mean, how did the business evolve from how it started into what it is now?
There's been relatively little change, but Waldo makes marmalade. His son, Edwin Jr., his big product introduction in the 1920s are Seville olives. And really, Richard and his son, Jeff, they've just been tending the fires and slowly steering people towards sriracha-based barbecue sauces and marmalades with a bit of an Asian flavor.
Wondering if California's changing economy maybe shaped some of the choices the company made?
The citrus orchard has shrunk from 30 acres to 2.5. So yes, over the past 100 years, they don't make as much preserve as they used to, and they don't grow everything themselves, which I think is really reflective of the California economy in general. Is they're outsourcing stuff a bit more, but they're really keeping their core And they've always kept their core vision and grown their core staples right there on site on their little 2.5 acres of Southern California heaven.
Now, today, who buys the product today? I mean, and how has the business carved out its place in Southern California's market? Because it's very competitive here in Southern California. What makes it stand out today?
Customers, loyalty. Mm-hmm. People find them in the local community. Jeff really has just continued to connect with people that have been shopping with him for generations. And again, this honesty and this simplicity, I think it just radiates out to everyone that's looking for one of these last great Southern California citrus and preserve shops.
Now, place has been around over 100 years. That's some pretty good equity in
yes.
the community. Yeah.
Yes, that is their selling point, and that is what people gravitate to, and that's where they get all their heavy lifting in terms of outreach.
That's Richard Shave with Esoteric Tours. He spoke with us today about E. Waldo Ward and Son Marmalades, a 100-year business in Southern California. Richard, thanks as always.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And given the effect of the coronavirus on small businesses, we checked in this morning on E. Waldo Ward and Son. And rest assured, the shop is open. You may struggle to find their barbecue sauces due to difficulties obtaining certain ingredients, but there is marmalades aplenty, and they confirm they have no plans to close anytime soon. All right, we need you. We need you right now, the Take Two, the KPCC listener. We still have to fundraise. We canceled it to give you important coronavirus pandemic news. Please give us a call at 866-888-5722, and thanks. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Comedian Aida Rodriguez has lived a lot of life in her 42 years, and it wasn't always sunny or funny. As a kid, she was kidnapped twice, once by her mom from her dad, and then from her mom by her grandma and uncle. But she managed to get to college, where she met her future husband, an NFL player. She got divorced, moved to L.A., and lived with her two kids in her car. Now, most of her life story goes into her act as a stand-up comedian. You can hear Aida on Tiffany Haddish's Netflix special called They Ready and an upcoming HBO Max sitcom based on her life. In the first part of our conversation that we aired yesterday, Rodriguez explained how all those experiences inform her comedy today, which can be raw but very real. We laid the foundation of yesterday's chat with a clip of Alan Alda defining comedy.
Comedy is tragedy plus time. Tragedy plus time. See, when the night Lincoln was shot, you couldn't joke about it. You couldn't make a joke about that. You just couldn't do it. Now time has gone by, and now it's fair game.
And in the second part of our interview, she explains how her mixed heritage helps define her personal mission today. You see, her mom is Puerto Rican, her stepfather is Cuban, her biological father Dominican.
And the internalized racism that we have, the colorism that exists in our culture, is part of the reason why we struggle so hard to be a united front in all of these, fields. And specifically, I can talk about entertainment. We complain so much about being such a big market and why we don't have a presence in media. And it's because we're so divided, because the colonization of our minds has been so powerful that we even divide ourselves amongst each other.
It's a struggle, she says, she experienced firsthand while growing up in New York and in Miami.
My Cuban stepfather's family, pointed out my Afrocentric features and used words like ordinaria and, things that we learned when we were young.
Yeah.
That's common language for us. And no, we like to accuse Cuban Americans like they're the only ones that participate in that. But it's a lie, because we all have that. Puerto Ricans use words like jabao because we don't want to say black. And Dominicans, you know, have a lot of the anti-blackness amongst themselves and Haitian Americans. And if you go throughout Latin America, you will see that everywhere. I mean, people insult Central Americans by calling them Indians. You know, those are our ancestors that we should be proud of. Yeah. And we have found a way to hurl it as a racist, bigot.
Either Colombians talk down to Ecuadorians, then Ecuadorians dip down and talk bad about Peruvians, then Chileans down at the bottom think that they're better than everyone else, right? I mean, we do it, it sounds bad on the outside looking in, but if you're in the club, it's kind of like what we do, right?
Yeah, but we don't realize that is hurtful, because what it does is it divides us. Yeah. So then when you see a Peruvian with a TV show, you're like, oh, I can't relate to that. I'm not an Indian. I come from Puerto Rico. I come from Taínos. And then it hurts us. But the funny thing is that we will all show up to watch Grey's Anatomy. Why? Because we like to see people, right?
Yeah.
And we treat ourselves as if we're not people, and our stories are not valid because we're ashamed of them.
Yeah.
I was raised by a Puerto Rican woman who is illiterate and migrated here in the 50s and was a victim of rape and abuse. And I will be damned if anybody makes me feel that I shouldn't be proud to be that woman's grandchild when she accomplished everything that she did in spite of all of the things that happened to her.
So I've heard you say a bunch of times in your act, can I say that here? Can I joke about that here? I mean, shouldn't you be able to say whatever you want, especially about your background, who you are, a woman of color, Latina?
Well, you have really been watching me, because a lot of people who are mentors to me have asked me to stop doing that.
What?
And they would say, stop asking people if it's okay for
you. Oh, good, good. Yeah, yeah.
They're like, George Carlin never asked anybody permission to make his assessments about society. People don't welcome that from me. I mean, I'll tell you, a major network turned down my comedy special because they didn't want to hear me talk about social issues. They said, we don't want to hear her talk about social issues. And I'm like, really? Michelle Wolf can make an assessment on feminism all day long, but a woman of color can't, because feminism does not include us. And so I just found a way to use my personal experiences as a vehicle to show my point of view about social issues. And you know this look what you're doing, right? You're an oddity. You're like, oh, you're on NPR speaking your subjects and verbs agree. Like, wow. Like, look at you. You don't have a heavy accent. For some reason, there's this misconception that Latinos don't have social point of views, that we don't have political point of views. We know that we're anti-communism because we hate Castro and what's happening in Venezuela. But there's a varied point of view amongst our people, just like everybody else.
We are not a monolith. That's for sure.
We're not a monolith.
Yeah.
And so it's even harder for a woman in comedy, because we don't even have a George Lopez, right? We don't have a Freddie Prinze as women Latinas. Yeah. There's never been a Latina to break the ceiling.
That could be you.
Well, that's what I plan to do. I mean, for me, this is not about being rich and famous. This is about breaking doors down for our people to say the things that we want to say that nobody ever thinks we have to say.
We're talking to Aida Rodriguez. You can watch her on Tiffany Haddish's Netflix comedy special, They Ready. Let me ask you one thing, because here's the thing. In that clip I played earlier about what comedy is, tragedy plus time, before that, Alan Alda says that in comedy, if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. Is there anything that you will not cross, any line you will not cross, where it could break and not be funny anymore?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't gotten to that point. I think that if you make a joke about pedophilia, and you tell a joke about pedophilia where the oddity of how in our culture we glamorize young women, i.e. JonBenet Ramsey, we glamorize that, and you make a social statement about that and a joke about that, you might make some people think about that. Now, if you make a joke glamorizing a pedophile, then that's not a good joke. I don't think if it breaks, it's not good. I think sometimes you gotta break it. I think the fact that it hasn't been broken is the problem, is that we only go to where it's safe enough, and then we don't wanna go the extra mile because we're afraid of the social consequences. But the reality of it is that we have to break it because we need change. And we cannot change things if we stay in the safe zone. And comedians, you know, are the people who are able to do that in a way where it's palatable because they do it through humor. So I think a great comic, I mean, Dave Chappelle broke a lot of things in Sticks and Stones.
Oh, yeah.
I would beg to differ with that. But it resonated with a lot of people.
Let me ask you this, because here's the thing. I've been ending every comedian interview with this scene from the 1981 comedy History of the World Part 1. Mel Brooks, mm-hmm. Describing how he sees what the role of a comedian is in society.
Next, occupation.
Stand-up philosopher.
What?
Stand-up philosopher. I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
Oh, a bullshit artist.
All right, so Aida Rodriguez, stand-up philosopher in a really crazy time. What would you say to someone searching for logical comprehension of everything going on in the world right now?
You know what? I would say go read a history book. funny that you said History of the World Part. I love the movie. Go read a history book and read about the despair in the time where people had a plague and they didn't have the internet. You know, read about despair in third world countries where people don't have basic necessities and have the coronavirus. And when you feel like you have despair, you got to dig deep into what it is about you that makes you feel despaired. Because if it comes from privilege, you're in standing in a place right now where you need to learn a lesson. And if you don't come from privilege, then you're just enhancing your humanity. And I stand by that. I think right now, when we think about this thing that's happening, we've read about these plagues all the time in our history books, and we knew that people were dealing with stuff and didn't even have the basic necessities. There are people sitting in their homes, watching their 55-inch televisions, watching cable on the internet, cooking meals on their electric stoves, complaining about how messed up this is. And I just think that despair is... it's all based on perspective. And right now, this is a time to sharpen your perspective.
Aida Rodriguez, watch her on Tiffany Haddish's Netflix comedy special, They Ready, and soon on HBO Max. Aida, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for doing what you do. We need your voice and we appreciate it.
All right, we stopped our spring member drive so we can bring you uninterrupted coverage of the pandemic. But our need for member support does not stop. You're our largest source of funding. That's right, you listening right now. Now, to help us get to our $1 million goal, there's a dollar-for-dollar match going on right now thanks to the Harold and Colleen Brown Family Foundation. Your donation doubled up to $50,000 today, so please give now. KPCC.org, that's KPCC.org, or call 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722, and thanks.